Our guest today is James Perloff. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, available at Amazon, and The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline, which was published in 1988 and is still very applicable and classic. His website is jamesperloff.com. Okay, let's pick up where you left off.
Yes, we were just closing out Pearl Harbor, how it was provoked and foreknown. And we're starting to get into the pretexts for World War II. Now, we talked about the real motives for World War II very close to the outside of this show. But the public pretexts were, of course, number one, Japan and Germany want to conquer the world, and number two is the Holocaust. So let's deal with those now. And I want to take Japan first, Deanna, because I want to spend the better part of our program on Germany. But as far as Japan wanted to conquer the world, and people were told that, and they still believe it today, I want to point out that Japan is smaller than the state of Montana. And the idea that they're going to conquer all of Asia and then come over to America and conquer us is pretty ridiculous, but people believed it, and they still do. And in my article in Pearl Harbor, I've got an embedded clip, which you can also find on YouTube. It's from the public movie Our Enemy, the Japanese, which was made by the War Department to educate the public. And here's what the narrator, Joseph Gru, Council on Foreign Relations, told the people in this movie. You can hear his words, but I'll quote him exactly. He said, "The Japanese believe it is, quote, the right and duty of Japan's emperors to rule the whole world, to destroy all peoples and nations which stand in the way of its fulfillment. Their dream is to see Tokyo established as the capital of the world. World conquest is their national obsession," unquote. Now, you can watch the whole clip. It's about 20 minutes long. But it's interesting that as Gru is describing the Japanese as being obsessed with world conquest, all you see on the screen are these pictures of Japanese eating food with chopsticks and getting onto subway trains. You know, it's like like there's nothing to the claim except his words, you know. All right, and here's something very important he forgets to mention, which was that as far as world conquest goes, Japan was actually a completely closed society, a completely isolationist, until the United States fleet under Admiral Matthew Perry sailed in, what was it, 1854, and we forced mm-hmm. them to sign a trade in agreement under threat of naval bombardment. Right. So don't give me this jive about they wanted to conquer the world. And you were the one, you know, this is why I learned so much from your books, Deanna. You pointed out that Commodore Perry was not only a Freemason, but he was the father-in-law of August Belmont, who was the Rothschild's chief financial agent in America in the 19th century. I mean, that is incredible. You talk about your coincidences. Okay. So when how do people prove that the Japanese were planning to conquer the world? You know, if you ask someone, well,
I mean, it's ludicrous to even think of it.
Well, the proof that they gave at the time, of course, was that Japan had its troops in Manchuria, which is somewhat incorrectly called northern China, as well as other parts of China. And this is supposed to mean that they were trying to conquer the world. And what they don't tell you is they were there because of the threat of communism, primarily. Now, if you want to talk about world conquerors, take a look at the Bolsheviks. I mean, Trotsky and Lenin and then Stalin had absorbed the Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia. They attacked the Baltic states. As you know, Stalin invaded Finland. He invaded Poland. They absorbed the southern Muslim states that make up the southern borders, made up the southern borders of the Soviet Union, like Kazakhstan, and now mm-hmm. they're proceeding into Asia. Stalin seized Outer Mongolia and China's most northwestern province called Xinjiang. And so that's the Japanese never came into China until that happened. And I want to quote Dr. Anthony Kubik. He was chairman of the political science department at the University of Dallas, and here's what he wrote in his 1963 book, How the Far East Was Lost. Quote, "It was apparent to Japanese statesmen that unless bastions of defense were built in Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, communism would spread through all of North China and seriously threaten the security of Japan." But the State Department seemed not to regard Japan as a bulwark against Soviet expansion in North China. As a matter of fact, not one word of protest was sent by the State Department to the Soviet Union, despite her absorption of Xinjiang and Outer Mongolia, while at the same time Japan was censured for stationing troops in China, unquote. So to the Japanese, Dan, I want to point out that this was their version of the Monroe Doctrine. We have the Monroe Doctrine right in America that said we don't let foreign powers come into our hemisphere. And the Japanese felt the same way about the Soviet Union. They were not going to let them come in and take over Asia. And if people disagree with that and think, well, the Japanese had no right to send troops to fight communism on the mainland of China. And believe me, they were not just fighting Chinese. They had many severe skirmishes with the Russians. Even though there was no declaration of war, they lost 18,000 in one engagement with the Russians. They were fighting off communism. Now, if you think they didn't have the right to do that, let me remind folks that in the Vietnam War, we sent our troops halfway around the world on the pretext that fighting communism around the world was in our national interest. So if we could send our troops halfway around the world to do that, why couldn't the Japanese fight it on their own doorstep?
Exactly. Sure.
And the other thing I want to point out about this is that the Japanese were absolutely right. After we defeated them, communism did sweep Asia. By 1949, China was under Mao Zedong's rule. It was entirely communist, and we had to fight the Korean and Vietnam wars against the communists. So the Japanese were right in trying to fight communism there, and they were not on a mission of world conquest.
Exactly. Right. And when you look at the shenanigans behind the surrender of China and how people walked away, and, I mean, it was just so orchestrated and so sad. There's so much sadness, so much slaughter. If you look at behind the scenes and what some of the generals did, and you mentioned Freemasonry, and a lot of the people who engaged in World War II, the leaders were Freemasons. I mean, you can go down the entire list, and many of them were.
And one unfortunate thing about that is quite often the Freemason holds international Freemasonry above loyalty to his own country. Now, I speak of some of the high-ranking Luciferian Freemasons. I don't mean, you know, your Joe down at the Blue Lodge who, you know, wears a baseball cap and, you know, just goes to a lodge meeting once in a while. But we talked about this double standard where there was this unlimited tolerance for Soviet aggression. Never were the Soviets censured for expanding, but there was zero tolerance for the Japanese fighting them. And this double standard was really brought out. Now, I want to shift the conversation over to Germany now. Mm-hmm. In 1939, September, when the war broke out between Poland and Germany, what do France and England do? They immediately declare war on Germany. And we're told that they cared so much about the sacred sovereignty of Poland that they were willing to sacrifice the lives of French and British youth to save it. But notice that in September of 1939, Stalin and the Soviets invaded Poland. Any declaration of war against them by the French and the British?
Nope.
No, everybody yawns, ho-hum, who cares about Polish national sovereignty? And I should mention that when the war was over, Poland lost her sovereignty anyway. Stalin had her leaders executed. He occupied it with tanks and kept a puppet regime in place. Did anybody care about Poland's sovereignty at that point? Did America, France, or Britain care? No. But how could they not care? Because this war in which 60 million people died was allegedly begun over the issue of Poland's sovereignty. Makes no sense. If you're a critical thinker, it makes no sense.
Well, also, Poland was militarily superior to Germany. And we're led to believe that all they had was horses and horse battalions, and that's just not true. And they had conducted at least 8 sorties over German territory. Right. So Germany actually did have a reason to invade. In addition, there were many, many, many German citizens who were being slaughtered by the Poles and otherwise discriminated against just in every way, shape, and form that you could think of. Loss of their property, loss of their occupation, in addition to all the slaughter. And so Germany did have a reason to invade Poland.
Right, and amongst those massacres, we could mention the Bromberg Massacre, which even Wikipedia has an entry on that one. But let's we talked about, did Japan want to conquer the world, and obviously little Japan did not. But let's talk about, did Germany want to conquer the world? You know, I met a guy at church once, and the first time I was speaking to him, and he said he was involved with a Tea Party. And I commended him for being a political activist. And he said, well, you know, if we hadn't gotten active during World War II, we'd all be speaking German now.
Ugh.
And, you know, I did not have time to try and debunk World War II in a standing conversation. You know, it takes a long program like the one we're having today to do that. But I did say to him, you know, I really don't think that Germany had the capacity to conquer the whole world. But let's talk about this. Did Germany want to conquer the world? Because that's what the American people were told. The first thing I want to point out is that no document has ever been found in any German archive indicating that Germany intended to conquer the world. In fact, Hitler never stated publicly or privately that Germany was going to do that. And no German general or statesman or citizen ever stated that. And if you ask people how they know that, it'll usually turn out to be that they heard Humphrey Bogart say it in Casablanca.
Really?
I mean, what's the source of it? You know, Roosevelt said it, and, you know, Roosevelt said it, and Humphrey Bogart said it, but did the Germans say it? And I want to tell you an anecdote that was related to me. It was written, actually, in his book, SS Panzer Grenadier. The late Hans Schmidt was a revisionist truther historian, and he wrote about his experiences in World War II, which he subtitled A True Story of World War II. He was equivalent of a second lieutenant in the 1st SS Panzer Division. And during the Battle of the Bulge, he was assigned to escort a detachment that was leading American prisoners behind the lines. And they came at night, they needed to sleep, so they came to a French farmhouse, and he knocked on the door and asked the farmer if they could stay there overnight, and the farmer said they could stay in the barn. And by the way, he did not kick down the door and say, Achtung, Achtung, we are commandeering your property. He asked for permission. Well, the American prisoners and the German guards were in the barn, and the German soldiers found some schnapps that had been hidden in the hay. And they offered to the American prisoners first, and the Americans said no, 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 because they thought maybe the Germans were trying to poison them. But then the Americans saw that the Germans were passing the booze between themselves, and they realized that the booze was okay, so they accepted some. And now a very interesting conversation starts between the Germans and the Americans. And one of the Germans, one of Hans' friends who could speak English well, said, you know, we have a question we've always wanted to ask you Americans. He said, what? What are you doing over here in Europe? And
exactly.
One of the Americans said, well, you know, we have to stop you Germans from conquering the world. Well, the Germans just looked at each other and laughed because nobody in Germany ever heard that before. Nobody in Germany ever heard that idea. It was completely foreign to their thinking. But everybody in America, of course, had heard it, and that's what they believed, and that's what they thought that they were over there for. Now, I should mention that, Japan is smaller than the size of Montana, Germany is the size of Oregon and Washington, and the idea that they were going to conquer and occupy France, and then conquer and occupy Britain, and then conquer and occupy the Soviet Union, and then have enough troops left over to come
it's
over
ridiculous.
And conquer North and South America is ridiculous. And I'm going to quote Charles Lindbergh on this. You know, he's the greatest American hero of his time.
Absolutely.
Said this when he was with the America First Committee. He said, quote, "Let us not be confused by this talk of invasion. Great armies must still cross oceans by ship. No foreign navy will dare approach within bombing range of our coasts," unquote. And the point he's making here, Gianna, is that Germany did not possess a single aircraft carrier. You can't invade America without air cover. And, you know, if they tried to send troop invasion ships over here without air support, our Air Force would just go out over the ocean and bomb their ships to smithereens before they ever came in within range of our coast. So it would have been logistically impossible. Plus, there is not a single shred of evidence in any archive to indicate that Germany ever had such a plan.
Exactly. They were just trying to recover from World War One, rebuilding their country. Hitler was putting people back to work. They were working on their infrastructure. That was their objectives, is to take care of their own country, take care of their own people.
That's right, and very successfully. You know, when you look at what happened under the republic that preceded Hitler, the disastrous inflation, the horrific economic conditions, and Germany almost became the jewel of the economic world through its self-sufficiency that it had in the 1930s. But when you confront someone with the fact that it would be logistically impossible for Germany to conquer the world, and number two, that there was no evidence that they wanted to, they will fall back on this argument. They will say, well, look, even if they never said they were going to conquer the world, their actions prove it. Look, first they invaded the Rhineland. Then there was Austria. Then they invaded Czechoslovakia to get back the Sudetenland. And we appeased them each time. But then they invaded Poland, and we would appease them no more. And then they invaded France. And then they tried to invade and conquer Britain, but Britain stood the test alone, and the courageous RAF staved off the Luftwaffe. And so Hitler, unable to conquer Britain, turned his hungry eyes to the east, that they decided to conquer Russia. And that is the argument you will hear, and it's supposedly these wars that prove that Germany had the intent to conquer the world. And what I want to do, I want to take them one at a time, Deanna, and I want to work backwards, and I want to actually start with the invasion of Russia and see if that represented an attempt at world conquest. The first thing I want to note is that when Operation Barbarossa began on June the 22nd, 1941, Stalin had 170 divisions at his western border poised for attack. That is why Germany struck. It was a preemptive strike. And even Leonid Brezhnev, the premier of the Soviet Union, admitted in his memoirs that Stalin had a plan to attack Europe. He thought that the war between France, England, and Germany had so weakened Western Europe that he would be able to pull it off. And if you ever wondered why the Germans captured so many Russian soldiers in the early going, it's because they were all bunched at their western border for attack. They were not arrayed in depth for defense. Okay. The other point to be made regarding whether or not the attack on Russia represented world conquest is this. It wasn't just Germany invading on Operation Barbarossa. It was the armies of Finland, Croatia, Hungary, Romania, and Italy. So you've got six nations combining in this attack. Also, as you know, Deanna, you know all this, Deanna, but even though Spain was technically neutral, 47,000 Spaniards volunteered to fight on the Eastern Front alongside the Germans. And because they had seen what the communists did in Spain when they herded whole congregations into churches and burned them down. And what were the Spaniards and the Finns doing in Russia? Were they trying to conquer the world too? In fact, here's what something that really gets me. When Finland joined Operation Barbarossa, Churchill had England declare war on Finland. But when when Russia invaded Finland in 1940, there's no declaration of war. You know, obviously Churchill was very afraid that Russia was going to be raped, sacked, and pillaged by the invading hordes of Finland.
Right. Sure.
Come on. If all these other nations were involved, is it world conquest? No. But this is what really got me was when I read a turning point for me was when I read Leon Degrelle's book, Campaign in Russia. And Leon Degrelle was a Belgian. And what I learned from his book was that two Belgian divisions joined the invasion of Russia in time. And there was a Flemish-speaking division and a French-speaking division. And I'd always been told, of course, the mainstream media version, that the Belgians were being enslaved by the Germans. These were not conscripts by the Germans. They were volunteers. And Leon Degrelle was personally decorated for valor by Adolf Hitler, who said he regarded him as a son. Leon Degrelle, by the way, I consider him a genius. I had to read his book with a dictionary at my side because the guy's vocabulary and his writing is so magnificent.
Indeed. It is. Oh, we're at a break. Okay, we'll be back in 3 minutes. We'll pick it up on the other side.
lenders. Are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
People love to shop. What if you could shop and it was actually good for you? What if you could actually purchase items that bettered your life? What goes into your body is important to what quality of life you have. How about shopping for items that better your health? GetTheTea.com is that shopping place. We're not only tea, even though that's our number one seller, we are about helping your health. There's colostrum LD for those of you with autoimmune troubles. The product helps your stomach get on track. GI problems produce pain. Get relief with colostrum from LD. How about some fat burners, or maybe some joint aid, or a power cleanse? There's so much to tell you with very little time. So get help health-wise at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Or you can call our friendly operators at 928-308-0408. That's 928-308-0408. Get help and relief by going shopping. Shop at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Serving people with great products for over 8 years. GetTheTea.com.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds, up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more, plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Our guest today is James Perloff. His website is jamesperloff.com, and I recommend that you visit that website and read his article on Pearl Harbor and on, well, on all the other great issues that he talks about. Okay, so are you talking about this wonderful, wonderful colonel? He was a colonel, and he also wrote Hitler Born at Versailles, which is a very good book.
Right. And you can see him interviewed, too, on some YouTube clips, because he was able to escape to Franco's Spain, and Franco wouldn't hand him over to the Allies for execution after the war. In fact, his flight to Spain from Norway at the end of the war was an amazing task in itself, amazing story itself. But the point we're making is that aside from the logistical impossibility of Germany conquering the world and the fact that there's zero documentary evidence for their desire to do that, we're subdividing it by battles now. We're talking about the Battle of Russia. And the point we're making is that if this represents world conquest, then what were the Finns and the Croats and the Hungarians, the Romanians, the Italians, the Spaniards, and the Belgians doing on the Eastern Front, fighting alongside the Germans? They were obviously there to defeat communism and right. Bolshevism. This had nothing to do with world conquest. I'm going to quote Otto Skorzeny at this point. Mm-hmm. By the way, this guy's getting a bad rep in certain media. I think that people don't know the man. Read his memoirs, okay? But here's what he writes in his memoirs about the Battle for Russia. Quote, like me, these volunteers wanted to fight Bolshevism and prevent Europe from being taken over by it. We wanted to defend our soil of Europe in Germany, not as Nazis, quote unquote, but as patriots and soldiers, unquote, Otto Skorzeny. Now, I'm going to mention, Deanna, that I've read many, many memoirs of German soldiers, U-boat men, Luftwaffe men, and I have never, I've read not only memoirs, but diaries, which were legal to keep, but some did keep diaries, and they were legal to keep because they didn't want them falling into the hands of the enemy, of course.
Sure.
In letters from the Eastern Front, and I have never read a letter from a German soldier to his wife where he said, "Greta dear, you know, I can hardly wait till we conquer the Soviet Union so we can move out of that awful house in Berlin and we can move and live here on the frozen steppes of Russia in a mud flat with a thatched roof. I can just hardly, you know," nobody wanted to conquer Russia. They all wanted to go home.
Of course.
And I wanted to actually give you a real quote. And I found this in a beautiful book, Eastern Inferno, The Journals of a German Panzer Jogger on the Eastern Front. This is by Hans Roth. He died on the Eastern Front in 1943. But this is to his wife, okay? Quote, "The most beautiful, the most cherished dream is home, our home. Those who look at a photograph of their children worn out from constant handling, the light eyes of the women and girls in the photos whom we look at with a quiet smile, know this. Out here, we only have the strength to endure the hardships and exhausting tasks because of the love from home that embraces us, the dream of a white tablecloth, of a tender kiss. This is the source of our strength," unquote. And many more quotes like that in this book. These guys didn't have conquest on their mind. They had home on their mind. They wanted to get rid of communism and Bolshevism, take care of business, and head back home. Nothing to do with world conquest.
Sure. And as you said, it was a defensive war. They were defending themselves, and the Soviets were certainly, they were not prepared to have a defensive
no.
war. They just figured that they were going to come into Germany, they were going to just take over Europe, and Germany stopped that process.
That's exactly right. That's the campaign in Russia. And now I want to take it back. We'll have to do this really after the break, but I want to take it back to this second phase, which preceded Russia, which was the war against France and England, and see if that represented an intention to conquer the world. And I'm going to quote again from another memoir. This is Adventures in My Youth, a German Soldier on the Eastern Front. I want to quote the description of the author. Armin Scheidenbauer was born in 1924, the son of an evangelical pastor. After attending schools, and it lists them, he was called up in August 1941. He served with distinction on the Eastern Front until 1945, with the 252nd Infantry Division, reaching the rank of Oberleutnant. Was wounded numerous times and awarded the Iron Cross First Class in close combat class. He was wounded and captured by the Red Army in March of 1945, returning home in September 1947. And I will conclude that at the other end of the break.
All righty, we'll be right back in 3 minutes.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Recent events have shown just how vulnerable we are to deadly viruses, bacteria, and fungus. These diseases are all caused by infectious pathogens that often get the upper hand on conventional medical treatments. Now more than ever, there's a great need for a product that will help protect us. Look no further. Supernatural Silver can provide immune system support to help fight off these deadly pathogens. Supernatural Silver is a new and vastly improved type of silver solution that's safe and extremely effective against 143 types of bacteria, both forms of viruses, mold, and yeast. Supernatural Silver can be taken orally or used topically and can be used in a nebulizer or vaporizer for inhalation. With over 180 scientific studies by independent universities, hospitals, and research institutions, Supernatural Silver is a powerful weapon against disease. Go to supernaturalsilver.com and use the promo code SILVER20. 2014 for 20% off your entire order. Give you and your loved ones a fighting chance with Supernatural Silver.
Roberts & Roberts Brokerage believes that everyone should have some of their assets in investment-grade precious metals. Roberts & Roberts has been a trusted name in precious metals for nearly 40 years. Experienced investors will appreciate our personal service and low prices. If you're new to precious metals, we can help you find the products right for you. Give us a call today at 800-874-9760 or visit us online at rrbi.co. Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, when you're serious about precious metals.
Do you or someone you know suffer from chest pain, blood pressure, cholesterol, or irregular heartbeat? Are you looking for a more natural solution to overcome these health challenges? You hear the ads all the time. If this stuff's so good, why doesn't my doctor prescribe it? That's easy. Doctors are not trained in natural medicine. Extendivite Heart Tonic does want you to be as healthy as you can be, and it really works. Take Extendivite for 6 months and your doctor will say, I don't know what you're doing, but don't stop. It's working for you. Get the dependability of Extendivite. Just see how you feel in 6 months. A 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid is only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
For the most amazing, calming, brain-stabilizing, blood sugar, and natural addiction-breaking formula, try CalMind. Anxiety melts, panic is gone, sleep is restful, and you'll stay calm during stress. Better than booze, mind-altering drugs, or anti-anxiety, antidepressant, toxic medications, CalMind lubricates your mind so you'll sail through the day effortlessly. Order Dr. Bill Deagle's Nutridyne at 888-212-8871 or NutriMedical.com and listen to the NutriMedical Report on GCN with open lines every weekday. NutriMedical, bringing nutrition and medicine together.
While the large majority of Americans have never heard of cryptocurrency, it is the medium of exchange of the future that has already begun. On the other hand, the large majority of RBN listeners are very aware of the corruption within the Fed and the trillions in counterfeit money and credit it has created. Well, would you like to do something about this? OneCoin, the fastest growing company of any kind in world history, will pay you to help do away with the Federal Reserve. Henry Ford didn't invent the automobile, but he surely developed many great improvements in the industry. In 1927, talking pictures made silent movies obsolete overnight, and email has practically done away with the need for a fax machine. With cryptocurrency, Bitcoin became the pioneer in 2009. But now OneCoin, as the first ever gold-backed cryptocurrency, has moved to the top of the industry in only 2 years, and its impact on the financial world could be devastating to the Fed. Bill Gates and Richard Branson and all the jillionaires are already acknowledging that this system of paying for goods and services is becoming what will be recognized as the new worldwide reserve currency. For more information, call Pat Shannon at 601-212-0911. Again, that's Pat Shannon at 601-212-0911.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is James Perloff. His website is jamesperloff.com. All righty. Continue.
Just before the break started, I was quoting the description of the author of this book, whose name is Armin Scheiderbauer. And I was describing his returning from Red Army captivity.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Adventures in My Youth, The German Soldier on the Eastern Front.
Okay.
It says in his description, in his post-war years, he became a senior lawyer in Vienna and continued his close associations with the Evangelical Church. He married a doctor and had one daughter, also a doctor, for whom this memoir was originally written. Unquote. Now, I bring this up for two reasons. One is that he was an evangelical Christian, and we're supposed to believe that Hitler eliminated Christianity, and I've even been told stories that how we had all the churches throughout the Bible, and we replaced it with Mein Kampf. This is the kind of stuff that the Zionists get Christians to believe in, but this guy was a Christian. I should mention that every German soldier in the Wehrmacht had the phrase "God is with us" on his belt buckle, and
right.
they had chaplains, both Catholic and Protestant, just like our army did. So
sure.
They were. This is not an atheist army we're talking about here. The atheists were over on the Bolshevik side. But the other reason I wanted to mention Scheiderbauer is that in his memoir, which was written for his daughter, he explained why they fought France and England, and he explains it very simply. They declared war on us. And when another country declares war on you, you have no choice but to fight. And Dana, when I was first, in school learning about the war, we were taught that the Blitzkrieg was this really vicious, evil form of new warfare developed by the Germans, the most cruel warfare, where you had these combined armor and air attacks, right? But what I realized and discovered was that actually, in an irony, it was a more humane form of warfare, because the Germans remembered World War I, where for years they had this trench warfare with millions dying on both sides. And they said, we're not going through that this time. Sorry, guys. So what happened? They made a brilliant strike through Belgium around the Maginot Line in May of 1940. By June of 1940, France had surrendered. The British were beaten and had to haul ass out of Dunkirk. The war was over as far as Germany was concerned. In 1 month, the war was one and done as far as Germany was concerned. So I would call it a type of warfare greatly preferable to the endless trench warfare that killed countless millions on both sides. Just insanity in the First World War. They said, we're not doing that again. Now, we should mention Dunkirk. And the fact is that the Germans let the British go. I wouldn't question for a moment the heroism of some of those small boat captains that came over and got guys. But if the Germans wanted to, they could have taken their tanks in and slaughtered the British on the beaches. They had them pinned against them. But I just want to quote German General Gunther Blumentritt, who visited Hitler's headquarters at the time of Dunkirk. He said, quote, speaking of the Führer, he said, quote, he then astonished us by speaking of his admiration for the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and of the civilization Britain had brought to the world. He concluded by saying his aim was to make peace with Britain on a basis that she would regard as compatible with her honor, unquote. All right, now, if people think that Germany wanted to invade Britain, I want to point this out. When the armistice was signed in Paris in 1940, Germany had 3.8 million troops in France. Hitler immediately demobilized and withdrew 3.3 million back to Germany, leaving behind an occupation force of 500,000. Now, does that sound like he's getting ready to invade Britain?
No.
Okay. Now, Pat Buchanan has written a great book, and I'm sure our listeners would agree that Pat Buchanan is not a Nazi skinhead. He's written a book called Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. He makes the point in his book, Deanna, it's a great point. If Hitler intended to invade Britain, why didn't he ever build any troop ships or landing barges or ferries for tanks? He had zero intention of invading Britain. Now, some people will say, what about Operation Sea Lion? Well, Operation Sea Lion existed only on paper. Hitler never once looked at the plans, and it was a general rule around headquarters that if Hitler didn't look at the plans, he had no intention of executing. The main reason for Operation Sea Lion was, number one, as a last-ditch contingency plan if Britain would not end the war, and also to bluff out Stalin as they were moving their forces towards the Eastern Front, to let Stalin think that maybe there was going to be something going on between Britain and Germany to catch Stalin off guard when they finally hit with Operation Barbarossa. But Churchill himself knew from his decoders at Bletchley Park that there was no invasion. He knew that as of July 1940. So all that talk about come over here and help us, America, that was nonsense. Now, you were talking earlier about Germany's peace overtures to Britain, and I want us to go into this in some detail. I knew about five or six of them, and when I read your book, I discovered there were more than 20. But first, let me just talk about the segue from Dunkirk to those peace offers. We're always one of the proofs that is alleged to show that Germany wanted to conquer Britain is, of course, the Blitz, the bombing of London. But what they never talk about in mainstream history books is the fact that it was the British who started that bombing. And I'm going to quote the British on this so nobody thinks that I'm bluffing, okay? I'm going to quote J.M. Speight, Principal Secretary to the Air Ministry, that is the Royal Air Force. Quote, Hitler only undertook the bombing of British civilian targets reluctantly 3 months after the RAF had commenced bombing German civilian targets. Hitler would have been willing at any time to stop the slaughter. Hitler was genuinely anxious to reach with Britain an agreement confining the actions of aircraft to battle zones. Unquote. J.M. Speight, Secretary to the Air Ministry. My next quote is from Dennis Richards in his book, The Royal Air Force, 1939 to 1945, published by Her Majesty's Stationery Office. Quote, "The primary purpose of these raids was to goad the Germans into undertaking reprisal raids of a similar character on Britain. Such raids would arouse intense indignation in Britain against Germany and so create a war psychosis without which it would be impossible to carry on a modern war," unquote, Dennis Richards. So who bombed who first? It was the British. And, you know, people talk about the British casualties and the London Blitz. I should mention that Churchill always left London when a German air raid was coming because he knew from his decoders that the air raid was coming. So he kept himself safe while leaving his fellow Londoners to suffer under the bombing. I've seen different figures on this. I've seen a couple sources say there were about 60,000 British casualties from the bombing. Now, some might say it was more, but I'll tell you, it was many more than that in just one night at Dresden when hundreds of thousands died in a single night. You know the story, Deanna, when they dropped 650,000 incendiary bombs. We might mention that when they bombed Hamburg, the temperatures reached 1,800 degrees. They turned it into a tornado hellstorm with winds at 155 miles an hour. It was so hot that the asphalt melted, and little children running down the street burst into torches. And talk about a Holocaust.
I just even hate to even picture this, imagine it.
There are some clips on YouTube of Hamburg and of Dresden that people can watch and look at. But the first civilian bombing took place of Germany. The RAF first bombed out on May the 11th, 1940. What a coincidence. That's the day Winston Churchill became prime minister.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think that we should talk for a moment about Mr. Churchill. You know, there's a famous quote.
He's a piece of garbage.
There's a famous quote where he talks against Bolshevism from 1920. I'm sure you've seen it. It's frequently quoted in alt media where he talks about, you know, quote, from the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx. And he talks about the Jewish domination of the Bolshevik Revolution. In fact, let me quote him. He said, quote, "There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and the bringing about of the Russian Revolution by those international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews," unquote. But you know what happened with Churchill? He got under the control of the Zionists. He had huge losses in the 1929 stock market crash. So Bernard Baruch, our old friend, bailed him out. And they had more stock losses in the stock market crash of 37. And this time he was bailed out with 18,000 pounds from Henry Strakosch, Jewish gold mining magnate. Then he came under the control of the Focus Group, a group of Zionist bankers led by Robert Whaley Cohen, the managing director of Royal Dutch Oil. And he was also seen as right into the thumb of Victor Rothschild, who has been identified as the fifth man in the famous Burgess-McLean spy ring, but never arrested because he was a fantastically wealthy banker. I believe he's the father of Evelyn de Rothschild, right? But Churchill completely changed it. Look at Churchill's attitude change. Look what he says about the Bolsheviks in 1939. Quote, "The loyal attitude of the Soviets to the cause of peace and their obvious interest in resisting the Nazi advance to the Black Sea and part of feeling of encouragement to all the eastern states now menaced by the maniacal dreams of Berlin. I know of no government which stands on its obligation, even its own despite, than the Russian Soviet government," unquote. Quite a change there over 20 years, huh?
Sure.
It's amazing what a bailout will do.
It wasn't that he was a decent man before that, because he was a scoundrel.
And right, with Lusitania was before
exactly.
that.
Exactly. I mean, he knew the truth, and he just didn't have any character. He was greedy, and psychopathic. I always resort to that, because anybody that would send planes to areas, to cities that were not really military targets.
Right.
I mean, that is sad, very sad.
They were bombing soldiers in Dresden and Hamburg. The soldiers were all out on the Eastern Front. They were bombing women, children, and old people.
And schools and hospitals and all kinds of places. It was just, and the zoo. I mean, who the heck would bomb the zoo? It was just.
Well, it's been ironically pointed out that Hitler had more interest in preserving the British Empire than Churchill did, because, as you know, at the end of the war, the British Empire was basically nullified. It had gone broke.
Right.
But let's talk about the peace offers now. And as we mentioned, more than 20 of them. Here's some that I was aware of even before I read your book. In Switzerland, June of 1940, the papal nuncio, the diplomat of the Vatican, mm-hmm. persistently contacted Sir David Kelly, the British ambassador, with peace offers from Germany. August 1940, Franz von Papen, the German ambassador to Turkey, informed the British ambassador there that Hitler was prepared to restore independence to Poland, Belgium, and the Netherlands. By the way, they're going through neutral countries. These offers came through Switzerland, Turkey, Sweden, Spain, the United States, and the Vatican. Any place that was neutral, the Germans tried to offer peace to Britain. September 1940, Lars Ekberg, president of the Swedish High Court of Appeal, informed the British ambassador that he just received word from Berlin attorney Ludwig Weishauer, a direct emissary of Hitler's, informing him of a plan for peace that would include leaving the British Empire completely intact in recognition of a Polish state. Karl Haushofer, Professor Haushofer, told the OSS in a post-war interview, quote, "In 1941, Germany put out peace feelers to Great Britain through Switzerland. Albrecht, that's his son, was sent to Switzerland. Mm-hmm. There he met a British agent, Lord Templewood. In this peace proposal, we offered to relinquish Norway, Denmark, and France," unquote. In response to, for example, the Vatican's peace feelers, Churchill said, quote, "I hope will be made clear to the nuncio. We do not desire any inquiries as to terms of peace with Hitler. All our agents are strictly forbidden to entertain any such suggestions," unquote. So Churchill shut the door, and anybody who did entertain a peace proposal, you know what happened? 18B. The 18 beat him, throw him in prison. Sure. And his people under Churchill were terrified of hearing from the peace proposal from Germany because they thought they'd go to jail, and some of them did.
Exactly. The other thing is, and somebody Skyped me about this regarding Churchill, he is the guy that wanted to and did use gas in the Middle East. And this was, I'm not sure what the period was, but he just didn't care. He promoted the use of gas. He promoted the use of all kinds of, well, like the incendiary bombs. And it was during the period between the First and the Second World War that the United States and Britain were getting their armaments together. They were preparing for war when they should have been fixing their own countries. They were preparing for war. And we know that we had soup lines here in America mm-hmm. during the Depression, and it was because all the money was going to prepare for war with Germany. Germany was always the target.
And isn't that happening today, Deanna, when veterans can't get a few hundred bucks worth of benefits, but any time they want to start a new war in the Middle East, Janet Yellen's got that Fiat machine cranked up. Here's $100 billion for a new war. They never have problem financing a new war, but no money for the people.
Exactly. Yeah.
It never changes. Well, I wanted to talk about, I think we're going to come up on a break pretty soon, but I wanted to talk yep. about the ultimate peace offer from Germany, and this is the Rudolf Hess flight. And you know, Deanna, what's the way this personally brings me in is what totally turned me around on World War II was when, in the late 90s, the History Channel, when it was still a pretty good channel, ran a one-hour documentary on the mystery of Rudolf Hess. And it intrigued me, and I said, well, what's going on with Hess? And when I pulled that thread, then I learned about all the other peace offers, and I suddenly realized that I was on the tip of a huge iceberg and a sea change in my view of the Second World War. But let's start to talk about this, and we'll have to finish it at the other side of the break. But Rudolf Hess was Hitler's personal deputy and is the only man besides Hitler who could sign a peace treaty. And on May the 10th, 1941, Rudolf Hess flew an unarmed Messerschmitt fighter right through the British defenses with a peace proposal. And the timing of this flight is not coincidental. May the 10th, 1941 is the month before Operation Barbarossa is about to begin. The Germans do not want to fight a two-front war. They know how disastrous that could be. They are desperate at this point to end the war with Britain. So Hitler is sending his own personal deputy Führer to Britain to try to bring this war to a close. He was actually supposed to land at the estate of the Duke of Hamilton at his airstrip, but Churchill got wind of the plan. Those airstrip lights were turned off, so Hess had to think fast, and he turned his plane upside down, and he parachuted to the ground, something he'd never done before. And he was captured by the Scottish Home Guard, and eventually then seized by the British, and Churchill had him thrown into the Tower of London. Now, Churchill could not deny that Hess had come to Britain because too many people in Scotland had seen him. So they had to come up with a story. So here's the headline in the London Times. Quote, Hitler's deputy escapes to Britain. Here's the New York Times headline. Hess, deserting Hitler, flies to Scotland.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, if that was true, why didn't they march him out to have a press conference to say how he was renouncing
Germany? Exactly. Perfect thing to do. All righty, we're going to a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Do you have difficulty taking supplements? Are you searching for a high-quality, complete nutritional drink that your whole family will love? NutraMedical's Life Support has arrived. All of your daily nutritional requirements in one quick, delicious drink. Dr. Bill Deagle's Life Support is a proprietary blend of vegan protein, activated vitamins, essential minerals, amino acids, probiotics, green tea, digestive enzymes, anti-inflammatories, cancer prevention, detoxification, and much more. Your body will high-five you for this one. Life Support is the best complete nutritious meal replacement on the market. Whether you are an elite athlete, have post-operative challenges, chronic illness, elderly, or a family that just wants a quick, delicious drink, try Dr. Bill Deagle's Life Support for optimized nutrition in one great-tasting smoothie. Just add cold water, almond milk, fruit, or anything else you like. NutraMedical's Life Support. Try our great-tasting chocolate or vanilla today. Call 888-212-8871 or visit us online at NutraMedical.com. NutraMedical.com for the whole family.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
You, your husband, your wife, your children, we all need food. And with dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Hey folks, John Stettmiller here. We at RBN understand, which is why I personally searched out a storable food company and one with similar core values to us here at RBN and of course you, the listener. Well, I found such a company. I'd like to introduce you to Numana Food Storage. Numana Food Storage, highly nutritious, GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemical preservatives or soy, and Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. To back up my claims, we've made Numana Food Storage the exclusive food sponsor of RBN. Call 888-597-0775, 888-597-0775. Order online at NumanaRepublic.com. That's NumanaRepublic.com. Food storage you'll love to eat.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. James Perloff is our guest. His website is jamesperloff.com. And right before the break, you brought up a really good question. If Hess was renouncing Germany and renouncing Hitler, it would have been the most, he would have been fabulous. He could have been giving speeches and they would have, well, I'm sure that they interrogated him. They did interrogate him and they knew exactly what he was there for. And so they concealed him in solitary confinement until they murdered him decades later.
That's exactly right. And you know, the story about him deserting Germany didn't hold up for long because Hesse told his Scottish captors that he had come with a plan for peace. Mm-hmm. And this made it into some of the local Scottish newspapers. And it got across to America on an uncensored newswire. And the story was picked up by American Mercury magazine, which was one of the few, you know, independent journals, that Hess had come with a peace offer. Now the story reaches Congress. And so Roosevelt's got congressmen and senators coming to him saying, look, if Germany's offering peace to Britain, why do we have to send all this lend-lease to Britain? What do we need to bother the taxpayers for? So now FDR contacts Churchill and says, we have a problem on our hands. So now Churchill said the maggots in the apple, and he took a walk with his press baron, Lord Beaverbrook. And Beaverbrook revealed this in 1962. It was Beaverbrook who came up with a new idea, a new plan. Now they would not say he was deserting Hitler. Now they would say he was a lunatic and a madman.
Right.
And Beaverbrook suggested to Churchill that they send an army of psychiatrists to Hess to validate this claim. And by the way, one of those psychiatrists was Donald Cameron, who developed MK Ultra for the CIA. So you can be sure that besides interrogation, they were probably electroshocking the guy and drugging him and doing everything they could to make him look crazy in order to validate this new claim.
Sure.
After the war, Hess was sent to Nuremberg, and Churchill was pretty confident he was going to get a death sentence. And in fact, the British judge and the Russian judge did pronounce death for Hess. However, you had to have 3 out of 4 judges do that. And the French and American judges said, well, the guy spent almost the whole war in Britain. How can you really say he committed a capital offense, you know?
Sure.
So he got off with life imprisonment. And Spandau Prison. Now, here's where it really turned into a mystery, and a lot of people got fascinated by this. But now, by 1967, all the other prisoners had either died or been released. Hess became the sole inmate of Spandau Prison for the next 20 years. Now, this prison was designed to hold 600 prisoners. It had a rotating guard of 200 soldiers under French, British, American, and Russian command. And the cost of maintaining this one man at Spandau was $100 million a year. Now, during his 46 years of imprisonment, Hess never once was allowed to discuss that flight to Scotland with any historian or the press or even his own family. Even his own family could only ask him things like, how's your health, how's the food, you know, but anything about that flight was off limits. In fact, when the American commandant at one time back in the 1960s, Lieutenant Colonel Eugene Byrd asked him about his flight, and he was placed under house arrest for doing that. You know, it was off limits. Now, the British were asked, you know, how come we got to spend $100 million a year on one guy in prison, you know?
That's a very good question.
Answer that on the other side of the break.
All righty, we will be back in 3 minutes. Stay tuned.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of 7 herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.